The headlines: a rights group denounces Israel as an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian territories. UN human rights experts urge the incoming U.S. administration to close the notorious Guantanamo military prison 19 years after it first opened. And also in our headlines, scientists at the World Health Organization warn that mass vaccinations will not bring about herd immunity to the coronavirus this year. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is the World News. Our top story for this half hour: an Israeli rights group says Israel is an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian territories. Betzalam says Israel has created a system over all the territory in which Jewish citizens have full rights. That's why the rights group says Palestinians are divided into tiers with various levels of rights, but always below Jewish people. Betzalam says Israel has effective control on the Gaza Strip, which the regime blockades. And in the West Bank, Palestinians live in disconnected enclaves under rigid military rule and without political rights. B'Tselem is a nonprofit organization that documents human rights violations in the Israeli-occupied territories. Mona Kandil says Israel treats Palestinians as if they are the minority and that they are not the real owners of the land.
It's the first time that B'Tselem is accusing Israel of apartheid. The report issued by B'Tselem saying that what Israel is doing on ground, it's not democracy and occupation, as it claims that the Israeli authorities occupy the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and a part of Jerusalem. Al-Quds. On ground, what's going on is apartheid between river and the sea. Because at the time the Israelis are occupying the West Bank, we are speaking about, let's say, 62% of the West Bank, where settlements are being built on a private Palestinian lands and on mountains, on hills. Jews are living there. They are having their full rights. Everything they want, they receive. At the same time, Palestinians, who are the real owners of the land, they are not receiving their rights. They are being arrested, shot, killed. Every day, Israeli forces storm the Palestinian lands in the occupied West Bank and arrest people. They confiscate their lands in order to annex it to the settlement. So they continue to treat the Palestinians as they are minority and that they are not the real owners of the land.
News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. Stay tuned, everybody. On this news review, a group of UN human rights experts have urged the incoming U.S. administration to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center as soon as possible. In a statement, the experts said the very existence of the facility is a disgrace for the U.S. and the international community. They described conditions at Guantanamo as inhumane and cruel, saying the prisoners' health is deteriorating rapidly. The human rights experts said the military prison is a place of abuse where the rule of law is suspended. They also said ill treatment is rampant in Gitmo and remains institutionalized. The UN experts issued their statement on the 19th anniversary of the establishment of Gitmo. The world body says currently 40 inmates are held there. It says only 9 have been charged with or convicted of crimes. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have former independent expert at the UN Human Rights Council, Mr. Alfred Desaias, who's joining us from Geneva. Also, we have ex-diplomat and expert on international affairs, Zamir Ahmad Awan, who's with us from Islamabad. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Desaias in Geneva. We're looking at the 19th anniversary of the establishment of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Why is it still open?
President Barack Obama promised way back when in 2008 that he was going to close it. He tried, but the Congress put all sorts of obstacles on his way. In any event, the United Nations Human Rights Committee, of which I used to be secretary, has repeatedly said that it entails a multiple violation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. As a special rapporteur back in 2016, I called not only for the closing of the Guantanamo facility, as they call it, I also called for accountability, because there have been serious crimes, particularly torture, committed systematically in Guantanamo, and that should not fall under general impunity. Now, there's an additional question here, which is sovereignty over Guantanamo. As you probably know, Guantanamo is militarily occupied and illegally occupied by the United States. The sovereignty over Guantanamo actually belongs to Cuba, and the United States has illegally exercised jurisdiction over the territory, notwithstanding the fact that the so-called lease agreement was imposed by force, and the lease agreement was also terminated by Cuba back in 1959. I wrote the article in the Oxford Encyclopedia of Public International Law concerning Guantanamo Naval Base and the reasons why the United States presence in Guantanamo is illegal. But right now, my colleagues, Neil Meltzer, Rapporteur on Torture, and the others, have correctly demanded the closing of Guantanamo Bay. That is step one. Step two will be, or should be, the prosecution of those guilty of torture in Guantanamo. The third step should be not only closing the facility, but returning the territory to Cuba.
Mr. Ahmad Awan, give us your thoughts on this recent report coming from the UN. One of the big questions here is, why aren't those who are being detained at the detention facility being charged or convicted of any crime?
Thank you. In fact, Guantanamo Bay prison is illegal, illegitimate. It is on the occupied territory. It is against the human rights. And the worst torture was given to the prisoner there. There is no legal system. And even that the persecution is illegal, illegitimate, and inhumane. And most of the people kept in the Guantanamo Bay are from the Middle East, from Afghanistan, and you can say the majority of the Muslims. So we strongly condemn it, and we strongly oppose it. During the last tenure of the President Obama, he has promised to close it. And but of course, the military establishment in the U.S. was very strong, and they have not implemented the presidential desire. And now I think the U.N. is very serious on this issue, and the United Nations has its responsibility to protect the human rights and to protect the human life. I think the civilized world should stand with the United Nations, and we force USA to shut down such illegal and inhuman jails and prisons.
Mr. Awan, I'm going to stay with you for this next question. I was reading the report a little earlier, and the experts who had penned this report stated, if I recall correctly, that the Guantanamo detention facility has brought nothing but disgrace to the United States and to the international community as well. If that's the case, why the insistence on behalf of Washington to keep this detention facility open?
In fact, U.S. was a superpower, and being a superpower, they feel proud to violate everything. They believe they are above the law. they don't accept any validation from the United Nations or from the civilized world. And this was really their misconception. And now I believe the U.S. is also passing through the crisis. And there are some wise people in the United States, and they might recommend their government or force their government to shut down the such illegal things which are damaging the reputation of USA. They should come out of that superpower mindset.
Mr. Desais, you mentioned that Barack Obama, in the run-up to his presidency, promised that he would close Guantanamo. That didn't happen. And then came the next U.S. president, Donald Trump. I don't think anybody expected the likes of Donald Trump to want to close down Guantanamo. But what about Joe Biden? Are there any expectations that Joe Biden
indeed
will act to close Gitmo?
Joe Biden and to the new administration. And I am forwarding my study on Guantanamo Naval Base to Joe Biden, and also a speech that I gave at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, which was published in the Law Review of the UBC. In any event, it is quite clear that the U.S. occupation of Guantanamo is illegal in international law, and that what has happened, torture and other crimes in Guantanamo, are a disgrace for the world and for all countries that have kept silent about it. You may recall that when Ben Emmerson was a rapporteur on torture, that he presented a report to the Human Rights Council indicating that 54 states had participated in the illegal United States program of so-called extraordinary renditions. That is, 54 states have participated in the kidnapping of persons suspected of whatever, being a Taliban or whatever, and those persons were then kidnapped and sent to Guantanamo, over 700 human beings. Now, it is not just the United States. There is complicity here on the part of the United Kingdom, on the part of Poland, on the part of Romania, on the part of Albania, on the part of Egypt, many countries that participated in this illegal, shall we say, in this frontal attack on international law and the Geneva Conventions. Now, I would very much encourage all listeners to this program to write to Joe Biden and to say, do what Barack Obama was unable to complete. There is such disgust against the policies of President Donald Trump that I think it is now possible to close the facility, and it is possible to conduct investigations into the crimes committed in Guantanamo.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Alfred Desais joining us from Geneva. Zamir Ahmad Awan joining us from Islamabad. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here. Bye for now. Welcome back. The coronavirus pandemic continues to wreak havoc across the United States as the country has reported more than 22,000 fatalities for the second consecutive week. Data suggests that on average, the virus claimed over 3,200 lives per day. In the world's worst-hit country last week, new confirmed cases also hit a weekly high there. Cumulatively, over 375,000 Americans have lost their lives, and more than 22.5 million others have tested positive since the outbreak of COVID-19. The vaccine rollout that began in the country last month has also hit snag amid reports of slow vaccinations. Less than a third of about 25.5 million doses distributed could be administered so far. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization warned that herd immunity would not be achieved this year despite coronavirus vaccines.
Even as vaccines start protecting the most vulnerable, we're not going to achieve any levels of population immunity or herd immunity in 2021. And even if it happens in a couple of pockets in a few countries, it's not going to protect people across the world.
The chief WHO scientists urge the need to continue taking public health and social measures aimed at halting transmission for the rest of this year. Meanwhile, Brazil, which is the world's second worst hit country in terms of deaths, reported nearly 500 new fatalities, taking the tally to over 203,000. New cases there also rose by nearly 26,000 to more than 8.1 million. American and Brazilian presidents have faced harsh criticism for their lackluster response to the pandemic. Well, Japan says it's isolating and analyzing a new strain of the coronavirus that was detected there over the weekend. The new variant was detected in four passengers who had arrived from Brazil. The Japanese health ministry says there is yet no evidence to show whether the new strain is more dangerous or transmissible. But it says the new variant holds similarities to those recently discovered in the UK and South Africa. The detection comes amid Japan's struggle to contain the pandemic. The country has declared a state of emergency in several western regions to battle the virus. The Albert Siegel in Tokyo says Japan is focusing on balancing its economy despite possible dangers from the newly detected COVID variant there.
That strain that came from Brazil that seems to be a little unique, that's one thing, but they just detected yesterday the UK strain did make it into Japan. Apparently there was this individual that came to Japan from the UK that broke his quarantine requirements and held a dinner party with 10 people, infecting half of them. It's not known if it's infected beyond that, but the UK strain itself is in Japan, though it isn't widespread. There is a state of emergency, but it's not anywhere near as robust as the one from last year. And as such, a lot of businesses and individuals, frankly, are ignoring it. This last weekend was the first weekend that the state of emergency was in place. People have been going out. The estimate is the people going out is about 3.5 times higher than it was last year. Now, people are indeed concerned, and numbers are rising. Actually, the numbers are much higher now than they were last year, but the state of emergency is quite lower. The problem is that the government is trying very hard to balance the economy with the health measures, but it's just not doing a particularly effective job.
Indonesian divers resume search for the black boxes of an airliner that crashed into the sea with 62 people on board Saturday. Divers are combing through the wreckage off the capital Jakarta to find the devices. Authorities say they now have the approximate location of the black boxes after picking their signals. But strong currents and poor weather are a challenge. The flight data recorders are key to discovering why the Sriwijaya Air's Boeing 737 crashed. Its crew had reported no emergency or technical problems. 10 children have been among the passengers. Divers have so far found a number of bodies, but only one has been identified. A wave of resignations is sweeping through the U.S. administration following the siege of the Capitol building by pro-Donald Trump protesters. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf has said that he's stepping down. He is the third cabinet official to quit his job in the aftermath of the attack. That comes amid a growing list of resignations by White House aides. In the meantime, counterterrorism prosecutors have opened probes into Wednesday's storming of the Congress building. The raid claimed at least six lives, including two police officers. Federal authorities have made dozens of arrests on several charges, including domestic terrorism. The FBI has also warned law enforcement forces of more armed protests being planned for Washington, D.C. and 50 U.S. capital cities ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration scheduled for January the 20th. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are discussing the 184th sermon of Imam Ali alayhi salam in this book. And in this sermon, Imam Ali alayhi salam is talking about the qualities of those who are pious. We reached one of those qualities, which is actually the quality of contentment, where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Tarahu qani'atan nafsuh." You will see that his soul, as his heart, is in a state of contentment. And of course, this is a very wonderful quality of a pious person, that each person needs to achieve slowly and gradually, inshallah, if he wants to truly achieve the pinnacle of piety. We were discussing about some of the narrations that Imam Ali alayhi salam and other imams and the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam have mentioned regarding virtue of contentment. Of course, one of those narrations that I mentioned previously is this particular narration where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, is reported to have said, "Azra bi nafsihi man istash'ara at-tama'," that one who has greed, who feels greedy, is one who has a weak character. His character has weakened, and therefore he needs to strengthen the quality of contentment.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him. Allah, 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 Allah.
Now, of course, there are many other narrations that are there. One of the other narrations that is there is where the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam have said, "Kafa bil qana'ati mulkan," that contentment is enough as a kingdom, is enough kingdom for someone. Kafa bil qana'ati mulkan. What does this mean? This is quite a deep narration where Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to tell us that a person who is pious gets such a, so much, is able to own such a, you know, treasure, such a treasure, that it is enough for him. He doesn't need anything after that. He's a, as if he's a king. Okay, he is, because he has what he wants, right? Which is the perfection of coming closer to God. That is enough. That qana'a itself brings that contentment is actually that good thing that gives him that perfection that is required. Or for example, in another narration we have that خيار المؤمنين القانع وشرارهم الطامع. He says that the best of the believers, if you want to know which believer is a good person, which believer is not good, he's bad, because a person can be a believer, but he may have some badness in him. So, because not all believers are completely good in all fields, isn't it? Well, if you want to see that character that is really bad for a believing person, it is when a believer is greedy. A greedy believer, he is very bad. While the best of believers is one who is content. Or for example, in another narration we have that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam have reportedly said, "La sharafa a'la min al-Islam." There is no nobility greater than that of being a Muslim. "Wala 'izza a'azza min at-taqwa." And there is no, you can say, greatness or honor bigger or greater than the honor of being pious. "Wala ma'qala ahsana min al-wara." And of course, he goes on and goes on, inshallah. We will continue this narration after the break.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
So the Imam continues in the narration after saying, "La azza azza, la azza azza min al-taqwa," that there is no honor greater than the honor of piety. And then he says, "La ma'qala ahsana min al-wara," there is no safe haven better than the safe haven of staying away from evil deeds completely, even from those that are doubtful. So that's a very good safe haven, because when you know that I will stay away even from that which is doubtful, when I doubt something is, you know, not good, I will stay away from that. "Wala shafi'a anjaha min at-tawbah," and there is no intercessor more that can make you more successful than the intercession of repentance and asking for forgiveness. "La kanza aghna min al-qana'a," there is no treasure which is richer than the treasure of contentment. So this was the actual place that I wanted to discuss about, that the one, the greatest of treasures, you know, is that treasure of contentment. And as I mentioned before, why is it such a great treasure? It's because it is that thing that truly causes a person to become perfect. The perfection of a human becomes perfect. I mean, that is the thing that actually is that richness. What does richness help you? Richness is when you have something that is truly there, truly perfect, truly good. So beyond these perfections of the soul, the other material things are not of true intrinsic value unless they are at the service of the soul and the heart. And that is why we say that the person who has reached a level whereby he is happy with what he has materially, with the decisions of God in all senses, legislatively and ontologically, he has reached that state whereby he has that goodness that is required for him to become perfect, and therefore it is the richest of things. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing A Revolution in Four Seasons, directed by Jesse Dieter. And joining me in the studio, we have Carol Allen, who writes for CloseUpFilm.com, Movies One, and is an editor and film critic for AEA Digest. And beside her is Catherine Shakhdam, who is a political analyst and director of the Shakhbakhner Institute of Middle Eastern Studies. Now, A Revolution in Four Seasons tells the story of two women with opposing political views fighting for different futures in Tunisia, the country that sparked the Arab Spring. Though, as this documentary shows, there are many unexpected challenges that lay ahead in trying to fight for a better future for your country.
We can, little by little, show the drawbacks of drinking alcohol, the drawbacks of wearing the bikini.
I was the first person from this village to be elected in the parliament.
Our people are waiting us to start writing the constitution.
They wrote one article of the constitution. there is a change since the revolution. Now the Tunisian society is divided.
I could have been in the United States, but you put me in Tunisia because you have this crazy idea that this country can be a democracy.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on. And so this documentary takes you on a journey into the lives of two very different Tunisian women, and who both embraced the revolution but have completely different visions for the future of their country. Carol, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on A Revolution in Four Seasons?
Well, it's interesting and important to see the world of two women from a very different country, as I said, very different point of view, with whom we have more in common than we might think. I don't want to go too far ahead, but at one point, for example, both of them get married and they have their first babies. They both have to cope with a problem which is universal for women throughout the world. How do you have your place in the world and still fulfill your duties as a wife and mother? And interestingly, it is Jawara, the more conventionally Muslim lady, who solves it most easily in that she is involved in politics. She's a member of the Constituent Assembly, which is writing the Constitution, sorry. And her husband, he helps her a lot. The other woman, Emna...
Who's a secularist in the film.
She is a secularist. Well, she is a Muslim, I think, in that she observes the fasting rules, but she doesn't wear the hijab. Right.
She wants to see a difference between religion and the rule of the country.
Yes, she wants a more she wants, as it says in the trailer, a state which is like Sweden or France, whereas the other lady is a member of the Islamic Democratic Party, and she wants an Islamic state which is still democratic. Which is a concept we in the West probably find quite difficult because we tend to think Islamic, and we're very wary of it. So it was a very positive film from that point of view.
And quite refreshing to see that.
Yeah, Jawara, she really impressed me. I thought she was she's a lovely, intelligent, thoughtful woman. She's not a scary Islamist at all. I'd like her to be my friend.
Catherine, I'd like to bring you in here. What was your take on the documentary?
I found it very interesting. I mean, to be fair with you, I didn't expect that I would actually enjoy it because, you know, I thought it was going to be one of those, you know, movie on the so-called Arab Spring. But what I found particularly interesting is that you have those two women who, you know, at the beginning of the documentary, you expect to be kind of, you know, on the opposite side of the river, I would say. They're actually quite similar in their hope for Tunisia, which is essentially to empower the people and have a system that represents, you know, the people but doesn't betray, you know, their identity. And I think that, you know, the issue here is really identity, is how does, you know, an Islamic or self-identified Islamic country find itself, you know, not just within the region, but within, you know, I would say, you know, this desire to be democratic and this desire to function, you know, within the international community.
It is an interesting point that this documentary raises, that democracy is different for different people.
Exactly.
And has different interpretations.
I think for me that was the core issue that, you know, it's maybe not talked about, but it's there, where, you know, you have, you know, someone who wants to have a secular democracy, you know, like France, where, you know, the state and religion are quite separate, which is fine. And then, you know, you have the other point of view where she talks about, you know, identity, how not to betray your heritage and your tradition. I think this is something that hasn't been talked about, this necessity for the Islamic world to actually have a democracy that looks like them, rather than looks like a Western democracy. We need to understand that there are more than just one way to be democratic. I don't think they're that different. I think they're very different in their approach to democracy or how they would like to formulate it. But they come across the same issues where, you know, secularism is really good on paper to some extent, but then there's issue attached to that. And then the same thing when it comes to Islamism, where, you know, there was a lot of issue. I mean, when you talk about terrorism, for example, or how there was...
Actually, we're going to touch that on that a bit later on.
When you think that in order for me to be a progressive, I have to look like the Western people, to eat like them, to think like them, to have the same taste. This harms not only our identity, but the human identity itself. You cannot be just a subordinate to France or to the United States. and forget about your religion, forget about your history, forget about your language, even your language, in order to be just to be progressive, I think.
Carol, you mentioned a bit earlier how you were surprised to see, as a Westerner, a Muslim woman, a strong Muslim woman, getting involved in politics. And she also has a strong family life, and her husband stays at home. What was this like watching this for you?
Well, as I said earlier, it was a bit of an eye-opener. I mean, that particular point you raised there about the political woman, who is well-supported by her Islamic, her Muslim husband, whereas the French-speaking woman who wants to be who wants to be like Sweden or France, her husband, who has spent a lot of time in America, behaves pretty much like a Western bloke. He goes into politics and leaves her at home holding the baby, you know, with her life on hold.
And you can see their relationship became strained, whereas yes, the others didn't.
Yes. I mean, it is actually very good PR for the idea of an Islamic state which is not repressive and which can be democratic. In fact, the clip we just saw was reiterating the points that Catherine just made.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine, what do you think? Do you think this documentary shows the positive side of Muslims?
Well, it shows definitely that, first of all, number one, there is a space for women in politics and Islam. So this is not, you know, the two don't have to clash. And, you know, this idea that, for example, that women should not enter politics, I think is linked to, you know, Wahhabism, Salafism, radical Islam, basically, where it's Islam is being deconceptualized. It's taken away from its context, and it doesn't mean anything anymore. But what you see here is very interesting, because she's, you know, she's hammering on the idea of identity. And again, I think that it's, you know, we need to listen to what she's saying, because it's just, you know, it's a neo-colonial reaction, I would say, where, you know, whether she's right or wrong, there is this idea that the West is trying to impose a certain socio-political model, and there's a reaction against it, because people want to find their own way through democracy. And I think that if we want to have a real discussion on how we move forward in the Middle East, how we could enable and accompany those countries to actually find, you know, their way and be democratic, we have to make sure that we don't impose any particular model. And, you know, if you look at Iran, for example, which is I know that people will say, no, it's not, but it is a very progressive society. I think it's a perfect example of that, where it doesn't feel the constraint of colonialism. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be to identify itself against it. And I think that's what you see in Tunisia, is that Tunisia was, you know, recently, I mean, historically speaking, recently freed or independent from France. And yet you see how France is very much, you know, impacting the way that they think themselves forward in politics. And, you know, I think that the Islamists tapped into it, reacted against it, and somehow, I would say, you know, played it to their advantage. So it was a very good PR exercise, as you mentioned. But of course, you know, some of them were genuine, some of them less so. And so, you know, we saw the abuses that it led to. But again, I'm going to say that, for example, it took France 5 republics, 2 empires, and a failed monarchy to, you know, to finally be a democracy. So I think we need to give it time. You know, we need to understand that you don't become a democratic state.
I think, yeah, we're going to discuss more the future and the problems of the country that it faced.
The goal is to train community organizers. We believe that it's very important to have independent representatives in the Constituent Assembly elections. We're doing it Obama style, actually, here, you know, grassroots movement.
So I'd like to talk about the secularist movement in the documentary. It was Emna who was supporting a secular country for Tunisia. And Carol, what are some of the struggles that she faced in the pursuit of power?
Some of the struggles that she faces? Her chief campaign seems to be, her chief issue seems to be with the police, who don't appear to be democratic at all. And this is, you know, this is something which is not just a problem in Tunisia. And the personal issues I mentioned earlier about coping with being a person, an effective person in the outside world, and with her baby. I actually found her, I have to admit, a less interesting character than Jawahara.
Really?
But what is interesting as well, I knew very little about the history of Tunisia, really, until the Arab Spring happened. Again, an eye-opener for Westerners is we tend to think an Islamic state is going to be repressive, a secular state isn't. Well, in this instance, the dictator Ben Ali, was it?
Yeah.
He was a secularist, and when we come to the elections, the fear is that the secular party is going to bring back another dictator. So, the point that Catherine was making earlier about not imposing our view, our Western view of democracy, on other countries is very important, because we do tend to think, well, we've got it right. And you know, in the case of Britain, we had an empire, we had colonies, we know how to run things. And you actually have to respect what is there. It's quite natural for human beings to want more independence, to want a more democratic state. But I think they have to find their own way of doing it. And it rather looks like Tunisia is doing this now.
Do you think it's in a better state now? I mean, do you get a sense from the documentary that before the revolution it was in a bad state?
I get the sense from the documentary. I'm not always clear from the documentary what exactly was going on in Tunisia before. For example, Johara refers to the fact that women have had the vote for a long time. Then we get a caption with the first lot of elections in the documentary. This is the first time there have been free elections ever in this country. I know, can you explain that?
Yes, I was going to ask Catherine, well, actually. Could you give us
Well, women were given, you know, the right to vote. I can't remember when. It was quite early on. I think it was the 1950s or something, you know, because of France. And then, you know, when Tunisia became independent, it kind of carried on. And as you mentioned, Ben Ali was very, I would say, you know, secular, very progressive, at least, you know, by France's standards, and which is why he was, you know, quite well liked by the French government. There's a difference in between, you know, where all people can vote and they actually have a right to say something. And I think this is the problem here, is that it's not because you live in a secular, you know, republic, for example, that you actually have a say in anything. And I think that's what they refer to. The sad thing is that I get the sense that, you know, somehow both of them felt that their revolution, you know, the way that they imagined themselves to become free, was taken away from them, you know, for different reasons. So, you know, secularism didn't happen the way Emma wanted. And then, you know, for the other lady, it's, you know, she felt, I think, betrayed by this move towards, you know, radicalism, where there was an imposition of certain views, where she hoped that it was more an invitation to. And I think this is the main problem here.
And I wanted to mention another part in the documentary where Johara gave a powerful speech in Parliament talking about how they have to smash the terrorist stereotypes and work together. What did you make of that scene?
Well, I admired the power of her speech. That wasn't the scene that made the biggest impression on me, though. One that did, which is, again, very important to the image of Islam in the West, was at the end, towards the end, because terrorism isn't mentioned very much in the film, although I understand it is a problem that there was.
So facing the Muslims and the secularists.
Yeah,
the
I mean,
isn't the Muslim problem?
Indeed. But there is a terrorist incident towards the end of the film, and Juara says, "This is awful. This is not what my father taught me. This is not what is in the Quran. We must fight it."
Terrorism is in the heart of the capital. It's in Bardo. It's in the museum, next to the parliament, and especially I was there. I was there as a deputy, and I was there as an ordinary citizen. This is not the Islam I belong to. This is not the Islam that my father teaches me, and this is not the Islam that I read in the Quran. I can't read any verse in the Quran that justifying what they are doing now. It's a religion which preaches tolerance, which preaches peace. Then we have to fight them.
That was a really moving moment in the documentary, that fight for struggle. I mean, you get the sense that the revolution was in fact the easy part, and the problem lies in rebuilding the country. Is that the impression you got also?
Yes, and isn't that always the problem with revolutions? You know, it's all very well to tear something down, but then you have to find the right way of building something up. And another point that that lady made earlier in the film was the difficulty of reconciling being an idealist with being a politician. And that, again, is another universal point that she's making there.
And yeah, it's a very human story that this documentary tells also. And so 6 years on, Catherine, from the Arab Spring, what problems still persist in the country? We saw briefly there was an issue of terrorism.
Well, I think Tunisia, interestingly enough, I mean, started it off, and it's a blueprint, but it's a compounding of everything, all the issues that other countries in the Middle East are facing right now, which is terrorism, the discussion, secularism, Islamism. Where do we do? Could we find another way? And I think her silence, speaks volume, really, and it's really moving, because what do you say in the face of radicalism? What do you say before terrorism? Terrorism doesn't speak for any religion. So, here it's Islam, but, it could be Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, it doesn't matter. There is no religion that, preaches, violence. It's just ludicrous. It's a political construct. And I think that what you have here is the desire, is this attempt to have pluralism. And this is what I heard, throughout the documentary.
Acceptance and tolerance.
Yes, that people need to find a way to live together, to find a way to disagree, but not hate each other. You can hate each other's ideas. It doesn't mean you have to hate each other and enact on that hatred. And I think this is the main issue that you have, is that people have been taught, for whatever reason, that they live to live in this kind of binary construct where they have to be either, on this side or that side, hate each other or love each other. It doesn't have to be this way. And I think that a lot has to do with the way that the revolution was spoken out in the media, that kind of imprinted this idea, again, that they have to be against each other. Clearly, those two women have very similar paths. Even like I said, they're sitting on different sides of the river. But again, they're facing the same challenges. They just approach them differently.
And Carol, would you agree, is there a lot of misinformation in the mainstream media?
I think there probably is. Of course, I'm not in a position to know what's false and what's not. But yes, Catherine is absolutely right when she says that we can live together with different viewpoints. I hate what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. And that's what we need to actually get, not just in Tunisia and not just in the UK, but throughout the world.
And this is one of the most powerful messages you get from the documentary.
Yes, yes.
And so we're nearing the end of the film and this programme now, and I'm just wondering, what would you have liked to see in the documentary also?
What would I... I would have liked a little bit more explanation of the context. I got a little bit confused. I was very aware there was a Democratic Islamic Party because Joël Ara was part of it. They were taking a heck of a long time over writing the Constitution, somebody pointed out. A bit like Brexit, really. and then suddenly, when the president, or was he the Prime Minister, I can't remember, decided to cede and say, OK, we'll have another election, suddenly the Constitution was in place. I didn't realise how quickly that could be. So there were certain things about clarity which I would criticise.
Would you recommend the film, Final 30 Seconds to
You? Oh, yes, I'd be very interested. It's American. I don't know where it's been shown in America. It's a sort of film that might crop up on BBC 4 or Channel 4 or something here. And I think it would be an interesting one for us all to watch.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode. Thanks to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.